Continue on with the instruction in metta. And before I get into today's instructions, I want to talk in a little bit of a general sense, in that this particular form of metta practice, the idea behind it is there's a sort of categories of beings, and we end up until we get to the very last of the categories, which is all beings, by choosing a particular person for each of these categories. And each week we'll add another sort of layer. And theoretically, the sequence that we add these people in over the period of time we're going to be doing this gets more difficult as we go along. Having said all of that, for some of you, you may have already found that metta for self is very beneficial. For some people, it just like it's what's working for you. Feel perfectly free to listen to what I have to say about the other categories and then totally ignore me and do nothing but metta for self. That would be a perfectly valid way to practice. So metta is kind of flexible in that way. So and I'll talk more about that as we go along and how different ways we can flex it depending on how we feel. So tonight we're going to add in the next category beyond self. So this is, now we're shifting to someone other than ourselves. And this category traditionally is called the benefactor. So this is someone you look up to, someone who has been of benefit to you in your life, you know, has helped you out in some way or continues to help you out in some way or however you want to think of that. It's someone that's going to be easy to have thoughts of loving kindness towards because you look up to them. And you feel they're have been of great benefit to you. So it could be, you know, a teacher or someone you work with that has really sort of been your mentor. It could be that aunt or uncle who was just there for you and continues to be there for you these days. So it doesn't really matter who you choose. I might talk about that more later. But it's really important that you choose someone. So in the back of your mind as I'm talking now, you can sort of be thinking, well, who would I choose for my benefactor? Some people find this difficult. They don't have that any relationship like that in their life. But then you can choose, you know, some public figure that you admire, you know, the Dalai Lama, the Pope, Barack Obama, I suppose. I mean, whoever, you know, or Michelle Obama, maybe, you know, whatever it is that seems like someone who's been, has affected your life in a very wholesome and positive way. But there are some people you should not choose. One is a life partner. Too confusing. There's too much going on there. I mean, sometimes you look up to your life partner and sometimes they drive you around the bend, right? This is part of having a life partner. And so don't go there. That's way too complicated. So it's got to be, we're trying to keep things as simple as we can. To someone I look up to, someone who I admire, someone who has been, as the category name, benefactor implies, has been a benefit to you in some way. And then what we do is we simply change the phrases from may I be happy to may you be happy. Same phrases. So you've already got a set of phrases you sort of got comfortable with, whether it's the traditional ones or, as I said, some edited version of some sort that you feel comfortable with. So you just change the I to you. Other than that, try and keep the phrases the same, really steadily the same. so that we don't get confused. And that helps with the concentration aspect of things. Franny, were you waving at me to ask you had a question, or you were waving? Okay, go ahead, ask me a question.
I put it in the chat, but I don't think you saw it. Does this person, this benefactor, have to be alive?
It's thought to be better if this person is alive because it's easier to connect. But if you really can't think of anyone else, and old Aunt Mabel, who passed a while ago, is that was just the person for you, that would be fine. But it's better to pick someone who's actually alive because it's easier to get a sense of them in general. Good question, though. Okay, so we're changing the phrases from I to you. Now, there's a couple of other layers of this. One is that what those phrases mean for you and what they mean for your benefactor might be different things. So give some thought to that in a sense. What does it mean for this person who's your benefactor? See, that's when it's pretty hard to have someone who's passed away and say, may you be healthy. You know? Though, you know, maybe it's healthy in heaven or something, if that's your predilection, you know. But have some sense that for this person, it might be, those phrases might be different. Maybe they're older and their health isn't so good, so maybe may you be healthy has a different flavor to it. And so on. So you have to think a little bit about what it means for this particular person you choose. What do these phrases mean for them? And so just keep that thought in the back of your mind as well as you're picking a person. And then there's also the question of visualization. And now you're going to visualize this person. And what I've always found works for me, and what I'm having talked to other people, works for other people, is I visualize this person in a situation where I would normally be with them. In my particular case, this is a particular, my sort of primary teacher for a number of years, long time, 15 years. And almost all my interactions with him were just the two of us sitting in a room talking. So I actually visualize him being in the room with me, sitting right next to me, or sitting across from me, because it feels natural that's how I would see him. So once again, that's flexible. Maybe this person is someone you used to go hiking with, and the natural way to think of them is sitting on the side of that mountain with you, or by that river with you, or whatever, you know, in the family kitchen, in the old family kitchen or whatever. So it's like have an image that's meaningful and familiar in the sense of that particular person. And as we go through the various other categories, we'll keep doing this. We'll keep picking people in different categories and then going through this question of what did those phrases mean for this person? How can I best visualize them? This is a repeated pattern we're going to be going through for the next 5 weeks or so. Now, here's a common problem, however. Someone actually wrote to me after last week, and we talked about this a little bit. And that's that we feel bad about only picking one person. You know, maybe there's two or three people in your life that are really would be, and gee, I should, you know, if I choose so-and-so, then I'm leaving out so-and-so. And it's really important that we understand that this is not about them. We are not sending waves out that are, they're going to feel and go, oh, and go, woo-woo. Though they may, that may happen. But basically, this is about changing your habits of heart and mind. It's about changing your patterns of thought to ones that are more often and eventually always full of nothing but loving kindness. So it doesn't matter who you choose, you're just using them as a tool, in a sense, a key to help you connect to thoughts of loving kindness and fill your mind with thoughts of loving kindness, which is really all we're doing. Just filling our hearts and minds with thoughts of loving kindness. So don't worry about offending anyone or leaving someone out or feeling bad that they're, you know, you're not doing it for so-and-so. That's not what this practice is about. This is about changing our heart minds, which are, that's a big enough job as it is without adding more stuff on top. And as I said, sure, I think this energy does go out into the world, but how it happens and what works and what doesn't work is not something, we're not trying to do that. That isn't the object of the practice, to send this out into the world in this very specific sort of way to these specific sort of people. Okay. And this is equally important, is we somehow, if we're not careful, get this idea that as I do this practice, somehow or other, things should feel a certain way. There should be some sort of emotional content, contact, connection, pick your word, that we experience. And I actually want to read, this is from Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. And she talks very directly about this, and I think she does it better than I do. So let's stick with Sharon, the queen of metta here. In practicing metta, we do not have to make a certain feeling happen. It's like we're not trying to generate anything. In fact, during the practice, we see that we feel differently at different times. Any momentary emotional tone is far less relevant than a considerable power of intention we harness as we say the phrases. As we repeat, may I be happy, may all beings be happy, we are planting seeds by forming this powerful intention in the mind. The seed will bear fruit in its own time. When I was practicing metta intensively in Burma, at times when I repeated the phrases, I would picture myself in a wide open field planting seeds. Doing metta, we plant the seeds of love, knowing that nature will take its course and it will, in time, those seeds will bear fruit. Some seeds will come to fruition quickly, some slowly, but our work is simply to plant the seeds. Every time we form the intention in the mind for our own happiness or for the happiness of others, we are doing our work. We are channeling the powerful energies of our own minds. Pretty specific here. This is about our minds, not about anybody else's mind. So another question that often arises is, gee, this doesn't seem like Buddhism. This seems sort of like some sort of new agey thing. In fact, to be honest with you, when I first encountered metta, that was my first reaction. It was sort of like, this new agey hippy dippy. I could say that because I was a hippie, right? Hippy dippy stuff, you know. And I actually was quite resistant to this practice for a number of years, as a matter of fact, before I finally realized how amazing it was. So I think it's quite useful to look at this practice within the context of traditional Buddhist teaching, in particular, in terms of the Noble Eightfold Path. Because if it fits with the Noble Eightfold Path, it makes sense from a Buddhist perspective. So let's look, I have a list here. I mean, first I'll start off, I'll go through the traditional list. Right understanding. Well, the reason we do this practice is because we understand that our normal habitual patterns of mind and heart are not always, are not necessarily always full of thoughts of love and kindness. In fact, sometimes quite the opposite. And so the understanding is, oh, here I can, this practice allows me to start shifting those habitual patterns. That's literally what we're doing. We're changing the grooves in our mind, the patterns in our mind by doing the practice. So we understand that we're human beings, and human nature leads us sometimes to unwholesome, unkind thoughts and sometimes actions. And so what we're trying to do is use this practice as a way to shift that, to change that. Then wholesome intention, the second step on the Eightfold Path. Well, that's what Sharon was just talking about. This practice is all about intention. It's about forming this clear intention to fill our minds with thoughts of loving kindness, to the exclusion of anything else. Just let's fill our minds with thoughts of loving kindness. I mean, the beauty of the mind, I mean, as complicated as it is it only can have one thing going on at a time. So if I'm filling my mind with thoughts of loving kindness, I'm not having thoughts of any other sort. That's what this practice is doing. It's like literally, let's just stuff our mind full of thoughts of loving kindness and see what happens. See how that affects our habitual patterns. So we form this wholesome intention to do this, to actually do the practice and to fill our minds with thoughts of loving kindness. Then we have a skillful speech. Well, we're not actually saying these things out loud, but we are certainly, number one, practicing in silence, which is a form of skillful speech. And we're using words as the meditation object. We're actually using words to keep us going and concentrated. So this is speech in a way. This is internal mental speech, but it's still speech. Then we get to right effort. It's already probably fairly obvious to you folks that this is not a very passive practice. This is a very active practice that takes a lot of effort. It's to stay, keep the mind focused on those phrases, and repeating them over and over and over is effort, energy, virya. And if you look at the traditional way we think of right effort, in particular, what we're doing is we're cultivating wholesome mind states. You know, we're actually trying to fill the mind with wholesome thoughts. And when we generate wholesome mind states, we then do what we can to maintain those wholesome mind states. This is two of the four phases of right effort: to cultivate wholesome mind states and to do what we can to maintain them once they arise. Then we get the right mindfulness. And when I first started thinking about this, I thought, oh, I'll skip over this because this isn't mindfulness. But actually, it is. And this is something I was just literally today, I've taught this metta many times, and today I went, oh, wait a second. What are we doing? We're sitting there repeating the phrases, and then the mind wanders, right? We're thinking about blah, 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 blah. And then at some point, we remember. Remembering is another word for sati, which often is translated as mindfulness. We actually remember that we're practicing. We're mindful that we're practicing, and then we go back to repeating the phrases. So mindfulness is clearly a part of this practice. It has to be. If we're not mindful, then the mind just drifts off and we're off in fantasy land, and then the gong rings, right? So, or your clock goes off or whatever it is you're using to keep time when you practice at home. So there's definitely mindfulness involved at that. It's particularly at that point where the mind is drifted away from repeating the phrases. You've lost concentration. You wake up. You remember. And then you go back just repeating the phrases again. And then, of course, the last of the step in the Eightfold Path, right concentration. It should be pretty obvious at this point that this is a big part of this practice is about concentration, about just having nothing going on except this visualization, a little bit of contemplation of the meaning of the phrases, and that's so sitting sort of underneath, in a sense, the actual repetition of the phrases, you know, it's very sort of steady manner. So sure looks to me like this fits in very clearly with traditional Buddhist teachings. I mean, what's more traditional and basic than the Eightfold Path? You know, the first time the Buddha taught, what did he teach? Taught the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So, and then if you start looking at the Buddha's teachings, you know, start studying the sutta, which I spent some time doing, you start seeing that everything comes back to this same place. It's just like, here's another way the Buddha's talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. That's all that he's ever doing. He's just bringing us back and bringing us back and bringing us back. And this metta practice is just, on the outside, looks very different than, you know, especially if you're used to practicing, you know, mindfulness or vipassana, or whatever words you might use. It seems very different, but it's actually very much totally in line with the Buddhist teachings. And that gives me comfort, I think, that I'm not just sort of drifting off in the hippy-dippy land. I'm actually practicing with Buddhist practice very clearly. And that when I saw that, then I started really opening myself up to actually practicing metta as a practice. I wasn't going to tell you this, but I think it's an interesting story in a sense of how, like, as I said, when I first encountered metta, it was the first time I'd done a retreat in this Theravada tradition. And I was actually sitting with Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein on a 10-day retreat. And every day they had a period in the late afternoon, sitting period, where they taught metta. And my reaction was like, ugh. When they started doing it, it was like I would literally squirm in my seat. And so this was a 10-day retreat. So I got to, like, by day five, I would, it's that metta period again. And I'd go to the yoga room and do yoga because I figured that would be better for me than sitting there squirming. I couldn't even be in the room. That was my initial reaction to metta practice. And then I went on another retreat and another retreat. And I actually was having an interview with Joseph Goldstein. And I told him about this. And he said, well, his response was simple. He said, well, we'll have to do something about that. And I sort of like blew him off in my mind. Yeah, yeah, sure. You know, but I was this serious Vipassana guy. You know, I was going to be serious, mindful all the time. Then a couple more retreats, or I got to the point where I could sort of sit in the room and sort of grudgingly go along, but it wasn't like, oh boy, it's metta time, right? And then one night my primary teacher guy was talking about metta, and he said, now, you have to understand, Guy is a really intense, intellectual, brilliant scholar, teacher. And that was my image of him in my mind. He was kind of sweet, but he was like just brilliant. He could quote the Sutta and he gave these brilliant Dharma talks. So in this Dharma talk, he says, so one time I did one of my 3-month retreats, I did metta for the entire 3 months. And it was like I was shocked. Like, what guy did metta for 3 whole months and nothing else? I mean, it was like, it was shocking to me that he would do this. And then he said, and then after that retreat, for the next year and a half, metta was my only practice. And it's like, I almost fell off my chair. I was like, oh my God. And that, hearing him say that, the next time I did a month-long retreat, I did a month of metta. And it changed my whole understanding of this practice. It's incredibly powerful, purely Buddhist practice. Just has a different flavor, a different style to it, that's all. So if you're having struggles, just remember this story. You know, it'll come around. You know, just remember Joseph Goldstein's words, well, we'll have to do something about that. It took me a while, another 3 or 4 years to do that something, but it really has been an important thing for me to have done in my life. Okay, so having told you the story, now let's do some practice. And what we do now is sort of split the practice period, however long it's going to be. So if you're practicing at home and maybe you're doing 20 minutes, it'd be 10 minutes and 10 minutes, or whatever your practice time is. We split it in half. And for the first half, we always, I repeat, always do metta for self. Again. And again and again. And then for the second half of the period, we do metta for the benefactor. So if you're practicing at home, keep that in mind and sort of keep track of making that shift at the halfway point of whatever practice you're doing at home as you're listening to this recording. So I'll guide us into the actual meditation period, and then I'll shut off my mic and we can sit for half an hour. And about halfway through, I'll probably pop back in just to remind you to shift and maybe do a little bit of guiding there. But let's just find that comfortable position again. And close your eyes. Tune into yourself. I want to mention one other thing I've done from time to time while I'm doing metta for self. I've always found having an image of myself in my mind difficult. And I found that if I just simply tuned in on a very sort of large level, the actual sensation of my body, you know, in the Satipatthana Sutta, there's a line that I always felt was important, that you have knowledge that there is a body, not my body, just there is a body. And if I can keep that sense of body as I'm repeating the phrases, it really helps me stay connected to metta for self. This is just another way of approaching this, if it seems like you might want to try that. It's sort of a little tiny bit of vipassana underneath metta, I suppose. But in the broadest sense, like I'm not noting everything that's arising in the traditional vipassana sense. So have that image in the mind or that sense of body. As I said, review your day or maybe your week or whatever your life, and think about the wholesomeness you have. It's very important that we acknowledge our wholesomeness, the goodness we have, the things we do in our life that are full of loving kindness sometimes. Tune into that part of our nature. And then whatever phrases you're using, you just want to repeat the phrases, remembering if the mind wanders, you mindfully eventually notice the mind has wandered, and you go back and you start repeating the phrases at the beginning. Don't start in the middle. So may I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. So now it's your turn again to talk, to share, to ask questions, to just let me know what's going on out there. I'm curious about how you felt about the difference between practicing for self and practicing for the benefactor. I'm curious about how your daily practice is going, and has that been significant, useful, possible? All of the above, none of the above. And just in general, how things are going, either in general or just right now. How was it tonight? How do you feel right now, for that matter, after practicing loving kindness practice for half an hour? So I'm sort of opening the floor and looking for feedback and questions and comments and thoughts. And you can just wave and I'll call out your name, or you can so Deborah wants to speak. So go ahead, Deborah.
Yeah, I'm like you. You know, I've tried loving kindness meditation, metta practice a few times, and I really didn't ever connect with it. But I think maybe it was because I never had any real instruction in it. You know, just reading about it. So it's been going really good for me. Good. Really good. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's good. It's good that part of the reason it's working for you is you're practicing with other people. And that always is encouraging. That the importance of Sangha, I keep coming back to it when I teach. But it's like, oh, here's these other people I'm practicing with, and they're into this too. So it gives you courage to keep going, and so thank you everybody else for encouraging Deborah to practice.
Thank you.
Okay, Celeste, you turned your mic on, I noticed.
Yes, I just have kind of a simple question. I get why you would choose one person to focus on during a practice session.
Yeah.
Change to a different person for a different practice session, or now that I've chosen one person, do I just kind of use them as the emblem of my desire for this benefactor? Yeah.
Traditionally, you would stick with the same person for a long time. At a certain point, sometimes your relationships change. Or someone else comes into your life, and now they're your real best. And now, you know, but on the temptation to have a different person every session falls in the area of, well, let's make this more interesting, and also in the, oh, I feel bad about not having including that person, which we talked a lot about. So no, from particularly in terms of the concentration aspect of the practice, it's much better to stick with the same person for a long time. My benefactor, I've been using the same benefactor for 14 years. So, but I've changed as we get to some of the other categories, you'll see, oh, it sort of makes sense sometimes to change eventually. And a couple of the other categories I have changed. But benefactor, I've stuck with the same benefactor and the same self. I've stuck with that one too. For a long time. But so you'll see, and I'll talk a bit more about that when we get to some of the other categories as well. Okay. Anyone else, other thoughts, other questions, comments, thoughts? Don't be shy. Yeah, Billy.
So I'm not sure how to see if I can make this make sense. So in my weekly or my daily practice, this is the first time that I've done metta consistently in my daily practice. I did it for myself all week. And it seems like in the beginning, I can get into a place that feels like I'm doing it the right way, where I'm setting a good intention towards myself. But I'm not sure if it's the way that it's phrased or what, but it seems like about halfway through the session, because it's may I be safe, may I be happy, it almost starts to feel more like a prayer, where I'm kind of asking for those things rather than wishing good towards myself. Mm-hmm. And then I found myself experimenting with may you be, as if I was someone else, to get back more of the good intention. Is that something that you've encountered before?
I've encountered the prayer part of that, what you were talking about. And it's more, if the phrases aren't working, try, like, adjust the phrases a little bit. You know, same four phrases, same intention for the four phrases, but maybe you need something with a bit more content. Like, instead of saying, may I be safe, you can try, as I have done from time to time, may I be safe from inner and outer harm. Something that has a bit more juice to it sometimes makes it stronger. But it's not, this is not prayer in the traditional sense, because we're not praying, we're not directing these things to anyone but ourselves. A prayer is when you're directing this sort of energy outwards into some other being.
Right.
And we're not doing that. Hopefully we're not. We're just trying to feel good about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this is, for, as I said, for some people, just, you may be one of those some people, metta for self is the hardest part of this practice. Because it's something that we're just, as you've expressed it, you feel a little uncomfortable with the idea of it.
Yeah.
Hang in there.
Okay.
And as I say, see if you can experiment with the phrases a little bit, change them around, try a different set, you know, slightly different words, and see if that helps, gives it a little more juice. And that's just also something people do a lot, especially when you're starting something, this is new, it's quite all right to sort of, like, for each session for a while, have a slightly different set of phrases, so you find one that goes, oh yeah, that one worked, you know, and then stick with that one for a while and see how that goes. Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Emma, Carolyn had her, yes, go ahead, Carolyn.
I just had a simple question. I found, and I didn't even intend to do this, but I have found phrases that work for my metta for self. And I'm grateful that metta for self really works for me. I come from kind of a background of, you know, recovering from like the family disease of alcoholism and recovering from abuse and shame. And so metta for self is very soothing for me. And it really does feel like I'm an active way to change around a self-abuse, like abusive thought patterns. So I can see myself kind of dedicating myself to metta for self for a long time, because it is so helpful to kind of redirect my mind. Mm-hmm. But I love the metta for my benefactor, because whenever I visualize her, I mean, it just makes me so happy. So I'm grateful also that I do get those feelings. You know, sometimes I get very distracted, but I do get those feelings of, like, just love and joy doing, you know, metta for my benefactor. But I was wondering, without even meaning to, I just did the traditional phrases for her. For me, I kind of expand on the may I be safe from inner and outer harm. That really resonates with me. But without even intending to, for her, I went straight to the traditional phrases, and it really worked. Is that okay, or should I be committed to the same phrases?
Absolutely okay. Because remember what we said about what do these phrases mean for this person, which okay. is going to be different for you. these phrases have some very, very specific meanings because of your life and past. Whereas for your benefactors, maybe it's like a little more open in general. Mm-hmm. So the traditional phrases makes more sense. So yeah, feel free within the categories to have a little flexibility, as well as long as there's the four phrases in the right same order, same intention, that's fine. That's fine. Especially if you find that works. I mean, a lot of meta is, gee, did that work? Okay, let's keep doing it. I mean, that's really a lot of my approach to meta. It's like, oh, that worked. Let's do that again. It's a very valid way to approach the practice. So yes, that's fine. I think it's great. It warms my heart, as a matter of fact. Other thoughts, questions? Emily's hand is waving there.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you have to speak a little louder. You're all very soft voiced, Emily.
Oh, okay. So I have, when I meditate in the evening, and I'm sure that this is common, but I typically go to bed around 9 o'clock. So I find when I'm meditating, even if it's past 8 o'clock, I struggle a lot with staying awake. Mm. What does one do about that?
Well, there are a couple of things one can do about that. One is get up early and meditate in the morning instead.
Yep.
Practice standing up.
Mm.
Very hard to fall asleep standing up. Or just before you sit, go into the washroom, splash your face with cold water. Mm. Give yourself a little jolt. Those are all traditional antidotes to sleepiness. So any of those would work. But if it really is that's the time you can, that with your life, and I know you have a busy life, if that's the only time in your busy life where you can fit it in, then do what you can to stay awake by doing things that help you stay awake. They also say sometimes if you just before you sit, you shine a bright light in your eyes. It activates your brain. So experiment with things that give you a little jolt and to make you wake up. Yeah. The closer it is to bedtime, the harder it is to meditate, because the more likely it is you're going to be tired. So if you can shift the time to a little bit earlier or shift it to a different time, that'll see what works for you. But don't get discouraged. Just keep practicing. Okay, good. Any other thoughts, questions, comments, things to say? Okay, so I have, as always, a couple of things. One is, especially for people who are new to the practice, even if you've had been meditating for a long time and you've meditated, but you've had some other form to the practice, this takes time. This is going to take a little getting used to, and it'll take some time for it to sort of grow on you. So don't be surprised if at first it seems like, God, I'm just struggling all the time. Give it time to sort of mature. And trust me when I say, if you have right intention and you stick with the practice, it will mature. It really does change your heart mind. I'm speaking from personal experience. It's been very powerful in my life. So just be patient with it. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. Another thing, I just want to thank you all for coming. I want to thank you all for your generous offerings of Dana. I also want to remind you that especially if you're in any sort of financial difficult positions, which a lot of people are these days, and I understand that, don't feel at all obligated to offer Dana. Please do not feel obligated to offer Dana. Just come and practice. That's more important to me than anything else. So just mentioning that. And finally, of course, I can't finish without a poem. So this is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. And it's the first part of a much longer poem that just speaks to a lot of what I was talking about tonight. So I thought I'd read this. It's called At the River Clarion. I don't know who God is exactly, but I'll tell you this. I was sitting in the river named Clarion on a water-splashed stone, and all afternoon I listened to the voices of the river talking. Whenever the water struck the stone, it had something to say, and the water itself, and even the mosses trailing under the water. And slowly, very slowly, it became clear to me what they were saying. Said the river, I am part of holiness. And I too, said the stone, and I too whispered the moss beneath the water. I've been to the river before a few times. Don't blame the river that nothing happened quickly. You don't hear such voices in an hour or a day. You don't hear them at all if selfhood has stuffed your ears. And it's difficult to hear anything anyway, though, through all the traffic and ambition. Sounds like very good advice on how to practice metta. So let's just dedicate the merit of our practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for coming.